And today I'm going to talk about a project with Stephanie with the name, If No Information Gain Implies No Disturbance, Then Any Discrete Physical Theory is Classical. Let's first have a look at the talk outline. First, I'm going to give you an outline of the main result, just to give you an idea of where this talk is heading. And then I'm going to introduce things in a bit more detail. First, I'm going to give you an introduction to the framework in which we prove the result. Then I'm going to state the result in a slightly more technical way. If there's enough time, then I will give a short proof idea. And in the last section, there will be some discussion with a few further comments. So let's start with the first point, outline of the main result. Well, let's say first a few general words about quantum theory. Quantum theory has the remarkable property that every state space of a physical system has continuously many pure states. So for example, the Bloch ball, which represents the smallest possible system with no more than just two perfectly distinguishable states, has infinitely many pure states. Any state on the boundary of the ball is a pure state, so we have a continuum of pure states. And to understand our result, one might ask the following motivating question. Could it be that physical state spaces are actually discrete in the sense that they only have finitely many pure states? So one might ask, well, how can we know that the Bloch ball doesn't look like this, with the corners being the pure states of the theory? Maybe we only have not high enough measurement precision to distinguish this discretized version and still think that it's a continuous one. However, our main result is a strong argument for saying no, it's not possible that physical state spaces are discrete. Okay, how does our argument work? Our result is formulated in a framework of generalized probabilistic theories, or sometimes they are called convex frameworks or convex set frameworks or whatever. And we formulate our result by first stating, in such a framework, the states form any convex set, and this is why it's called a convex set framework. And we formulate our result by first making the following postulate. We say, we postulate that every measurement, or more precisely, every pure measurement, can be performed in a way such that the states with a definite outcome are left invariant. So if we perform a measurement and some of the outcomes has probability 1, then performing this measurement does not change the outcome. Okay, so since in such a measurement we don't have any information gain, we could rephrase this as no information gain implies no disturbance. And then our result reads as follows. A generalized probabilistic theory with finitely many pure states is either classical or it violates this rather intuitive postulate. So it leaves us if we insist that state spaces are discrete, we are left with these two alternatives. Either physics is classical, which we know quite well it isn't, or this kind of postulate is violated. So again, in a bit more tutorial fashion, if a theory has finitely many pure states, then either it's classical, in which case the states are described by a simplex, or they violate the postulate. So, for example, this discretized Bloch ball would violate the postulate. Okay, let's go in a bit more detail and discuss the framework. In the literature, there is more than just one framework of generalized probabilistic theories, and the one that which we are working with is called the abstract state space formalism. And you can derive this kind of formalism from four assumptions. Well, it depends a bit on how you count, but in the way that I count, it's four assumptions. The first assumption is that the states form a convex subset of a real vector space. For example, in quantum theory, the density operators form a convex subset of the vector space of Fermilian operators on some Hilbert space. And the idea, just roughly stated, is that if you take a probabilistic mixture, then you want the state to be a state again. So convex sums should map states to states. Then the second assumption is that the vector space is finite dimensional. There is no physical reason to require that. We make it to keep mathematics simple. And the third assumption is that the set of states is compact. And although one might motivate it in a physical fashion, for us, we shall be happy just to consider it as a technical requirement. Okay, and these three assumptions already determines how states look like in this framework. In a vector space, which we call A, we have a compact and convex subset of normalized states, which we denote by omega. So it might be, for example, a pentagon shape. And we have the subnormalized states, which are given by rescalings with factors between 0 and 1. It would be, from a physical point of view, it would be fine to deal with things in this way. However, it's mathematically more convenient to choose a different structure. Namely, we say we have a closed cone in the vector space, and we have a linear functional U. And this linear functional gives us the normalization of the state. So in the cone, we have states of any normalization, and this linear functional U gives us a normalization. So from these two things, we can also get the normalized and the subnormalized states. Namely, we intersect the cone with the affine hyperplane where the linear functional U takes value 1, and this gives us the normalized states. And those elements of the cone where it takes values between 0 and 1 are the subnormalized states. Okay, and this is what an abstract state space is. It's a triple A plus and U, where A is a finite dimensional real vector space, A plus is a cone, and U is a linear functional. Okay, we have discussed three assumptions so far. The fourth assumption, which will determine the framework, is about measurements. And roughly speaking, it states that every mathematically well-defined measurement is allowed. I will explain in a minute what this means. But the consequence of this assumption is that this triple A plus and U already fully determines the structure of one-shot measurements. So once these three things are chosen, we have all the structure needed to make measurement predictions in a one-shot experiment. In quantum theory, this would correspond to POVMs. Okay, now I explain what it means to be means that every mathematically well-defined measurement is allowed. We describe measurements by a set of functions f1 to fn, if we have n outcomes in a measurement, and these functions are called effects. The interpretation is that the effect fk evaluated on a state omega gives the probability for outcome k if the state of the system prior to the measurement is omega. And these effects are linear functionals, and since they represent probabilities, they have to be positive on the states. And if we look at all the linear functionals which have this property, then we get a cone in the dual space. And again, since they're probabilities, they have to be upper bounded by 1. And the linear functional satisfying that look like a cone pointing downwards. And the linear functionals which satisfy both are given by the intersection of these two sets, And in the case where the set has a pentagon-like shape, we get this, I would say, crystal-like shape. You will see this shape again later. Then a measurement is given by a set of effects such that the probabilities and the measurements sum up to 1 for every state. Okay, let's look at a few examples. One example we know very well is quantum theory, where the vector space is the vector space of Hermitian matrices on a Hilbert space. A plus is the cone of positive operators, and the linear functional giving us a normalization is given by the trace. And from these ingredients, we get the set of density operators. We all know it's the set of positive operators with unit trace. So we see that we can consider quantum theory as a special case of this framework. Effects are then induced by a POVM element, namely a density operator is mapped to trace of m rho, and this is a linear functional. To ensure that a POVM gives probabilities which sum up to 1, we require that the POVM elements sum up to the identity operator. Okay, let's have a look at some less familiar examples. One quite funny class of examples are the polygon models, which serve as some kind of toy model. They're quite nice because the vector space A is just three-dimensional, so we can draw nice pictures. And we can identify the dual space of R3 just with R3 itself. And we depict the linear functionals just in the same vector space as the states and take the inner product to evaluate them. In the case of a triangle, we have classical theory of three pure states. The square example is also known as the G-bit in the literature, and the other ones are just some fancy examples. A bit more generally, we can say that we can consider a polytopic theory. This is what we consider to be a discrete theory. A polytope is the convex hull of finitely many many points, and we interpret these points as the pure states. Examples of polytopic theories are the polygon models, which we have just seen before, or the G-bit, or the PR box, which is a bit more well-known in the literature, and also classical theories, which play an important role in our result.
What is the polytope in the PR box case?
What the polytope is?
The whole of a signaling polytope?
Yes. You take two squares and the maximal tensor product of it, and that gives you a polytope. Mm-hmm. Okay, since classical theories are quite essential in our approach, let's have a closer look at them. As I already mentioned, in classical theory of finitely many pure states, the state's omega form is simplex. A simplex is the convex hull of a finely independent points. Okay, why is a simplex a classical theory? Well, a simplex has the property that a point in the simplex is a unique convex combination of its extreme points. And if we interpret the weights in this convex combination as probabilities, then we can say, we can restate this fact by saying that a point in a simplex is in one-to-one correspondence with a probability distribution over its corners. Okay, what we have seen so far is the structure of abstract state spaces, and they determine the statistics of one-shot measurements. However, if we want to describe post-measurements in these states, or if we want to describe several consecutive measurements, then we have to consider more structure. So let's look at the description of successive measurements in such a theory. First, we start with a state omega and make a measurement m1, and we get some outcome I. The probabilities are calculated according to m1, which is a set of effects, and omega as we have discussed it before. Okay, now consider we make a second measurement m2 with outcome j. How do we calculate the probabilities? Since in an abstract state space theory, probabilities are calculated by combining states and measurements, we have to know what state goes inside. With what state do we start before the measurement M2? And this is the post-measurement state of the first measurement. So we need to know the post-measurement state. And we describe it by a transformation subject to the first measurement. In general, this transformation can depend on the outcome of the first measurement. I will make a quantum example in a minute. What do we expect from such a transformation? In order to ensure compatibility with probabilistic mixtures, we have to require this transformation to be linear. Also, it should map states to states and not to any other element of the vector space, so we require them to be positive. And we also want that such a transformation induces the effect. This reads as u after t is equal to f. The motivation is just that if we evaluate the normalization of the state after the transformation, then we want it to be equal to the probability for that outcome. As an example, in quantum theory, such a transformation is given by a projector P, and it maps state rho to P rho P. And this satisfies all we have just required. It's linear, it's positive, and it also induces the effect. Okay, now we can state our result in a slightly more technical way. Again, our postulate is that every pure measurement can be performed in a way which leaves the states with a definite outcome invariant. And in this framework, this means the following. If we have a pure effect f, and when I say pure, I mean that this effect is an extreme point of the set of effects. I will come back to this in a minute. Then there is a transformation on the spectral space which is linear positive and induces the effect. This is what we just required before. And according to our postulate, it should leave the states with probability 1 invariant. So if f evaluated on a state is 1, then t of omega is equal to omega. Requiring this postulate only for pure effects is technically weaker, but it's fully sufficient for what we want to show. Okay, our postulate is satisfied, for example, by quantum theory. If a projected density operator has trace 1, then sandwiching the density operator with a projector leaves it invariant. And classical theory also satisfies this postulate. And at this point, it's instructive to see this in a more geometrical way. As an example, we consider the triangle, which is simplex. And the set of effects looks like this cube E below it. And now we consider the effect F, which is at the front corner of this cube. This effect has probability 1 on the front edge. According to our postulate, this front edge has to be left invariant by the transformation T that we postulate. It has probability 0 at the corner in the back. And we require that the post-measurement state has a normalization which is equal to the probability. But the only state with norm 0 is the 0 state. So our transformation has to map that state to the 0 vector while leaving the front edge invariant. And if we look at the subnormalized states, this means that the set omega is, so to say, flapped to the front face of the subnormalized states. So in classical theory, there is no problem with this postulate. All pure effects have the transformation that we, the kind of transformation that we want. However, there are many theories which violate the postulate, and this is our result. We prove the following. Let the triple A, A plus, and U describe a discrete theory. We have said that this means that omega is a polytope, and assume that the postulate is satisfied. What we prove is that in this case, the set omega is a simplex. So in other words, the abstract state space describes a classical theory. So if we look at a few polytopes one might come up with, the only one which can satisfy our postulate is classical theory. Okay, the proof is mainly based on the following lemma. In this form, it's not very readable, and I would have to introduce quite much notation. So instead of discussing this technically, I want to give you a picture of, I want to give you some intuition about how to prove this result. Instead of these two technical conditions that have to be satisfied, I will just tell you what happens if they are violated. If condition A is violated, then something happens which we call the dimension mismatch. And if condition B is violated, then something happens which we call the shape mismatch. And for this, I'm going to give you two basic examples. The first example is the square. And in that case, what happens is the dimension mismatch. And the second example is the pentagon, where we have a shape mismatch. Well, and our result finally will be that for every non-classical polytope, one of the two things occurs. Okay, let's have a look at the square. Again, we consider a pure effect F, which is in the front corner. And as before, the states with probability 1 form an edge of omega. So this edge has to be left invariant. But now the states with probability 0 also form a whole edge in the back. Okay, what does it mean for our transformation? Let's look at this square again. Your notation is a bit different. However, this FF means the set of states with probability 1. The fact that they are left invariant means that on the span of FF, our transformation has to be the identity operator. On the other hand, we have that the states with probability 0 have to be mapped to the 0 operator. So on the span of that set, we have that our transformation T is the 0 operator. Now you can already see in a three-dimensional vector space, those two things cannot happen simultaneously. We have a one-dimensional intersection. And in this intersection, our operator has to be identity and 0 operator at the same time, which is not possible. So the two conditions just over-define the transformation in a way which cannot work. And this is what we call the dimension mismatch. Okay, now let's look at the other problem, which is illustrated in the example of a pentagon. Here we again take some effect F. It has probability 1 at some edge and probability 0 at a corner. So as in the case of the triangle, just from the dimensions, there is no problem. So we don't have, as before, that these conditions overdefine T in a way which cannot be satisfied. But something else happens. There is exactly one transformation which maps, well, which leaves the front edge invariant and maps the back corner to 0. But this map maps the states omega to this set, which is indicated by dashed lines. And we see that it maps some of the states outside of the state cone. In other words, it maps states to something which is not a state. So the positivity requirement is violated. And if something like this happens, we call this the shape mismatch. OK, the idea of the proof. The first step is to show that if neither of these two mismatches occurs, then our polytope omega has the following property. Namely, for every facet f of the polytope, there is some other point of the polytope such that the convex hull of the facet plus that point is the whole set. So if we consider this tetrahedron, for example, then I cannot really see the laser pointer. This facet here, for example, has the property that there is one point, other point of the polytope, namely this point here, such that the convex hull of this facet and this point is the whole polytope. However, it turns out that every polytope with this property is a simplex. So this implies that the theory is classical. OK, now we come to the last part, the discussion part, where I will have a few more comments about it. The first issue is the robustness of the theorem. Well, one might come with the following objection. One might say, well, I like your postulate, but the verification of the condition that T leaves the state exactly invariant needs infinite measurement precision. So it's not like the Bell inequality, where you only have to show a violation of an inequality, but you actually have to verify an equality. Well, we have a partial reply to this objection. Namely, one can weaken the postulate in the following way. We say that instead of leaving the state invariant, we only have to require that it does not disturb the state by more than some positive number epsilon. And if we weaken the postulate in this form, then we can still infer our result. However, the problem is that the epsilon that we choose to weaken the postulate depends on the polytope. So in other words, if we want to rule out a particular polytope, then I can give the experimenter some particular epsilon and tell him, well, if you measure up to that precision, then you can rule it out. However, to simultaneously rule out all non-classical polytopes, one still would need to have infinite measurement precision. OK, now let's have a look at an overview over all kinds of probabilistic theories and the ones which are ruled out by our postulate. What we have just said is that we rule out the theories which are read in this figure, namely all those polytopic theories which are not classical. However, there are much more theories than just polytopic theories. For example, there is quantum theory, from which we know that it is fine with our postulate. But there, for example, is some other class of theories, namely the strictly convex theories. This is just those theories where the set omega is strictly convex, which means that it is everywhere around. It has no facet which contains a line. And these theories also satisfy the postulate. So it's not that only classical theory and quantum theory satisfy it. Well, and what's with the rest in blue? We actually don't really know. Or let's say we don't have an elegant classification of what theories satisfy our postulate and which do not. For example, a state space which looks like a piece of cake, for example, is ruled out by our postulate, but a state space which looks like an ice cream cone is fine with that. We just have not, we just don't have an elegant description of what theories in general satisfy our postulate. Okay, there's some interesting aspect about our postulate, like for every other postulate which is considered in generalized probabilistic theories. One might ask whether this might be a starting point for a physical derivation of quantum theory. Well, how will this work? Again, we consider the set of all probabilistic theories. And as we have discussed, if we impose our postulate, then we rule out some theories, and we know there are some more theories left than just quantum theory. But maybe we find some additional postulates such that only quantum theory can satisfy all of these postulates. And if we find such postulates, then we could say that these could serve as physical postulates for quantum theory. And what makes our result interesting in this aspect? Well, the character of our postulate is very different from the postulates which have been considered in other approaches. Other approaches often consider postulates concerning non-locality and stuff like that, but we only deal with local state spaces and post-measurement states. And because the character of our postulate is so different, it might be that one can find a promising combination with other postulates which eventually might lead to a full kind of axiomatization for quantum theory. Yeah, that's actually it. Thanks for your attention. If you're interested in reading more about it, then have a look at the archive paper. Thanks.
Questions? So you gave an example where the dimension mismatch occurs, and an example where the shape mismatch occurs. Does the type of mismatch depend on the parity of the number of vertices?
Does it depend on what?
Does the type of mismatch depend on the number of vertices? So just, for example, if you have an even number, is it always shape or something?
Not really. For example, if you consider the regular polygons, which we have seen, then whenever you have an odd number of corners, then the dimension mismatch, for example, will never occur. But whenever you have an even number, then the dimension mismatch will definitely occur. So it's not possible alone from the number of vertices to say what will go wrong with this kind of shape. Actually, if you are given a shape, then this lemma which we have proved makes it easy to see whether the postulate can be satisfied for a particular effect or for a particular edge of the states or whatever, but it's not easy to see whether it's satisfied for all of them simultaneously. Yeah, but it's definitely not possible from the number of vertices alone to determine that.
When you set up your generalized probability framework, you have this last assumption that the set of all measurements is allowed.
Yes.
Which seems to me to be a much stronger assumption than the other ones you use to set up your framework. And in some treatments, it's treated as one of the axioms, for example, in Sanders and Muller. I wonder, how crucial a role is that assumption playing in your theory?
It does play an essential role, because what we need to infer the result is that for every facet of the polytope, so for every face with one, which is one dimension lower than the whole polytope, there is a pure effect which has probability one exactly on this facet.
Okay.
And if you require that all these effects exist, and you also require that its negation exists, then you already have, and if you take the convex hull of these effects, then you already have all effects which we call mathematically well-defined. So
okay.
Indeed, it does play a crucial role.
But just there, you seem to sketch out a way of proving that assumption from some other assumptions, such as the existence of pure effect.
That's actually an interesting point, and I would really like to have discussion about it, because it's something which we don't fully understand right now. What other physical assumptions can one make in order to infer this assumption, which now, in our case, is just a technical one?
Right.
Well, that this assumption can be inferred. Yeah, and to be honest, when we say we only require one postulate, then this is a matter of counting, because we just take a framework where this assumption is already made.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always the case. There are background assumptions. And then often in these proofs where you're trying to, these reconstructions of quantum theory, there's often a quite a difficult step trying to show that for the sort of a single generalized bit, the set of allowed states is the set of all states on the hypersphere,
mm-hmm.
and then subsequently you reduce down to the two sphere, and of course your theorem doesn't quite do that, I don't think, because you could have a set of infinite cardinality on the hypersphere but still not populate every single point on the hypersphere with a state. Is that right?
I'm not sure whether I fully understood your question. Your question is about like a generalized kind of bit, right?
Yes, you take a generalized bit, which I actually think I've been calling G bits, GE bits, but which is unfortunate. But anyway, so you take a generalized bit, and then often in these reconstructions of quantum theory, first of all, there's a step where you show that the set of allowed states has to be, has to lie on a hypersphere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that follows, for example, from the reversibility assumption made in some of the
treatments. Okay, yeah.
And there's a subsequent step where you show that every single state on the hypersphere for a generalized bit, every single point on the hypersphere actually corresponds to a physical state. So you get, like, you get the set of states is actually a whole.
I had an interesting discussion concerning the fact whether our postulate could be used, for example, to infer that a G-bit is actually strictly convex, so that you don't have a square for a G-bit or something like that.
Right.
And just these days, we had a look at, can we infer the strict convexity of such a bit from that postulate? Yeah, and indeed, if you assume that you have a set of states which is not strictly convex, then using the postulate, you can prove that there must at least be three states which you can perfectly distinguished. So,
okay.
Indeed, it does imply that.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Well, Maybe we'll have to figure out a few technical details, but we're quite sure that this is the case, yes.
So that's often a very tricky part in these reconstructions.
Yeah.
So if you have a way to get around that, then there's hope for turning it into a full reconstruction.
Yeah, some other principle used to get that that I've seen is, for example, that, again, you can measure all effects. Mm-hmm. And if you can encode one bit of information in such a GBIT, then you cannot encode additional information on top of this. This also gives you strict convexity in a slightly more direct way than our postulate would.
Right. Yeah. This is the sort of Dakitian and Bruckner assumption. At some point, okay.
Yeah.
If we take our definition of transformation and look at what it does in a quantum case, it's somehow more general than what can actually be realized in a quantum case, right? Using quantum operations. Because you don't have complete positivity. So would you expect that there is also some axiom on these transformations which would recover this, the right set of transformations in a quantum case, even on a single system level?
Thing is, if you want to talk about complete positivity in a generalized setting, then you already have to define extra structure on your theory. Namely, you have to say how you combine two systems to form a state of bipartite states, which is...
That seems like the natural thing to do, but maybe you can find some other kind of axiom which gives you the same, which gives you the same set of transformations.
Well, if I only look at the local state space, then the ones listed are the only ones which I personally could come up with.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and for the other ones, we never started to consider it because, as I said, you would have to add this extra structure. This is a point where we get lost quite soon because. You have the two extreme cases of the minimal and the maximal tensor product,
yeah.
But what do you do in between? We are quite much lost, and yeah.
Any more questions? So, I mean, if you want to take, your postulate, maybe other postulates to derive a kind of, to get back to quantum theory, it's kind of the last point. The one issue I can see, maybe people will disagree, is well, we have this thing called a measurement, it's this abstract thing which we define as a, within that framework, I guess there's two aspects to my question. How can we account for that to make sense of it physically? While still having the term measurement in as part of your basic postulates, or alternatively, could we not talk about measurements but some kind of type of process that's a bit more general and arrive at a similar sort of framework?
That very much depends on what you mean by a process.
I mean, it's kind of a very vague question I'm asking here, I think.
I mean, this approach and similar approaches very much rely on the idea that a theory is described by a description of states and description
right.
of effects, and that the combination of these two gives you a probability. If you want to get rid of this idea, then you really start with something completely different mm-hmm. from what we are considering. It's quite hard to deform this approach to do something else. I'm not familiar with these kinds of approaches, but I think other approaches like quantum logic or, might be different starting points from scratch to come up with such a thing.
I mean, I find it a very interesting result in the sense that we can talk about, this property of measurement is not meant to affect, property one states. and yet, so there seems to be something really interesting there. It could serve as a basis for physical theory. It just is for me that use measurement itself. I'm just trying to see if there's a way to avoid that and maintain some of the relatively strong result that we have there. I'm not sure if that's possible.
I'm not quite sure what would come instead of measurement. One thing where you could deform this approach is you could say, instead of talking about effects, you could say, all we can do is do transformations and measure the normalization, so to say. So if you would have an experiment with a beam of particles, then measuring the normalization is to put a screen and just check whether your system comes out of it. And this is actually what we meant by a transformation induces the effect. This would give you back an effect once that you have transformations given. But I think I'm not answering your question.
I'm not sure how well my question is defined, to be honest. It's more a general thought. Because I like this result. I just have a kind of feeling that as long as we stick to using measurements, something fundamental, we can't get to a truly physical theory.
I see. At least from the terminology, and arguably also in a ideological way, this approach is dependent on these notions. I mean, if one would come up with a list of postulates in which, in fact, in the end imply quantum theory, sure, this will not be the last wisdom. This will not be the all-explaining kind of thing. But it would shed some light on characteristics of quantum theory. There are, in fact, a few people which have come up with a full list of postulates which give you back quantum theory. But arguably, all of them have some drawback at some point.
This is still useful for, even if you think measurement shouldn't be play a fundamental role in whatever theory you think is going to be the final one. If you can derive from that your measurements have to satisfy this set of postulates, then you've got quantum theory. You've done sort of half the job for you, right? Anyone else? Let's thank Paul Simon here.